Hello, everyone, and welcome to NGF News. My name is Alec, and we also have Joshua Cheatham as well. For today's latest global developments, we're going to have two for today. We're going to be talking about the European Commission calling on the European Bank to fund defense projects, and Haitian gangs looking for control of the capital airport as the violence escalates in Haiti. So, you know, we're going to go straight into it, and we're going to start with the European Commission. So the European Commission urges the EIB, which is the European Investment Bank, to modify its policy after funding for defense projects amid heightened military concerns. The Commission proposes adjusting the EIB's group lending policies to support the production of military equipment, and this move aims to enhance Europe's defense capabilities, which is huge because they first initially started this kind of call for more defense projects in January of this year, where the EU and the European Commission and the EIB said, hey, listen, we need new technologies for our military. So what they did was they provided, I think I have it written down, 175 million euros for venture capital and private equity funds to invest in European companies and essentially European companies that have the technology or new technologies for the defense capabilities of the EU, which is quite interesting because we don't think of, well, in the United States, we don't think of investing in smaller mid-caps and startups for defense. We're always focused on the large Northrop Grumman, Lockheed, and all those big names. But the European Investment Fund wants to go small, which is interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. And like you said, it's just a new trend or a continuance of a trend post the invasion in Ukraine to call for more investment in defense and in increasing their industrial complex. I mean, everyone knows the United States defense industrial complex is the number one. It's where everyone calls to. It's why people go to the U.S. for anything when it comes to defense or war, and which is why we are the defenders of what we call Western civilization. But the EU and a lot of members have been doing it individually. We've seen France's budget go up. We've seen Germany's budget significantly increase. Poland, Hungary, Austria, Czechoslovakia, Italy, and outside of the EU, we're also looking at the United Kingdom's budget going up and investment in Ukraine. So this is definitely the continuance of a new trend. So the governing body has about 27 governments in the bloc. All of them would have to agree to this change. But to say that this is a new trend for the EIB is not completely true. They are able to fund defense projects more civilian/defense. So if it's a project that happens to do with AI, that is a civilian and defense use, which they are allowed to fund in the first place. This is more just for industrializing investments or investments in industrializing their, you know, their weapons, their tanks, their systems, their flight, their navy, all that stuff. So I think that's definitely something that's interesting to point out.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a domino effect of where you had these individual countries upping their budget, and the EU was like, okay, well, we have all these countries that are upping their budget. We might as well create a centralized kind of goal to increase everyone's budget overall. So it's kind of interesting. But like you said, this is not something that's new. They kind of wanted to push. They've always wanted to see more for finance defending, but they've always been a little skeptical. Because the EIB's kind of main focuses are net zero and a digitalized economy. Going to spend more into defense might deter private investors, partly because private investors don't want to invest in the EIB or have EIB money to buy weapons, kind of like a moral thing. And everyone has their opinions on, you know, about funding, you know, defense projects and the funding weapons. But you know, we're not going to say, oh, this is a good or bad thing. We're just giving you what's going on and, you know, what are the implications of it. And speaking of implications, this is a message to Russia saying, hey, you know, we have all these individual countries, but, you know, we're tired of you stepping on our back. So here's a here's a regional EU effort to show that we are committed to protecting our borders and to protect Ukraine. So I wouldn't be surprised if the EIB funds projects, funds companies, small, medium enterprises that will end up leading to a product that goes to the Ukrainian government, because a lot of these countries worldwide, the United States and other countries, have been hesitant so far on giving Ukraine more aid because of, one, well, we can't pass anything in the United States, and secondly, the EU. The EU has provided some support, but not full support. So I think this is also an experiment for the EIB to say, okay, what if we call on smaller enterprises to see if they're willing to do something for Ukraine?
Yeah, I agree. And the one thing that's so important about the EIB, too, is the amount of capital that they have to give out. The World Bank produces $170 billion a year towards different projects in terms of development and, like you said, low carbon, net zero carbon emissions. But the EU, the EIB, is the largest by a significant margin, $562 billion, almost $500 billion, or $400 billion more than the World Bank puts out in terms of what they give out to, you know, countries in Africa for development, in Asia, and Latin America, and within. So this is a very big opportunity for Europe to create this industrial complex with a lot of capital from not just within their own countries, but with the EIB, as well as smaller financial banks that can help out, or also smaller consulting intelligence firms. But I'd just like to track back a little bit. This is not to say that the EU didn't already have these things. Like you said, this is a EU effort, but individually, Booz Allen, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, any big company that works in defense has offices in London, Berlin, in Paris, in Rome, anywhere you can think of in the EU. They have that, mostly working on intelligence, obviously, but they still do have a significant industrial complex, especially in Germany and the United Kingdom. So this is just kind of saying, okay, we have this, how can we do a little bit more? And you're right, it is saying, you know, Russia, we don't want you to come onto our borders, this is what we're going to do. But I also think it's kind of telling the United States that, hey, you guys have been defending us, you become a little bit less reliable, but you've always been defending us in the past. We're going to try and build up on our own so that we don't have to rely on you, and that our fronts are strong everywhere.
Yeah. And it's kind of like they're taking the playbook out of the United States, or, well, a page of our book from the United States, and saying, hey, you know, we see you have so many contractors over here, each specializing in something else. Like you said, Booz Allen has all the intel projects, and so on and so forth. One produces, one does the intelligence work. But it's funny now, because the EIB is looking at this, and like you said, they have the offices abroad. They're like, why don't we do what they do and make it our own, and start and help these SMEs kind of turn into, you know, creating civilian stuff, but also work for us as well under government contracts. So we're probably going to see the rise of more like government contract work in the EU, which is going to, you know, raise jobs and create a bigger need for things like cyberspace and manufacturing, engineering. So this is definitely an interesting move. I don't know if the rest of these countries are going to be want to see this, because so far only the Baltic countries and Poland are like, yes, we need to do it. You know, other countries have been hesitant. But it's interesting, and I wonder where this is going to go.
Yeah, I definitely do. For me, I think it's a pretty important factor to take in, because there's plenty of reasons why no country would ever think of invading the United States. But our complex, because of how quickly we can mobilize and how good our intelligence is on the civilian and military and the federal side, there's plenty of reasons why they won't, you know, continuously try to attack us in the cyberspace or on land. But if you've seen recently in the news, Facebook went down just yesterday. AT&T went down about a week ago for all users. And they haven't come out and said explicitly that they're cyber attacks, but we can infer and make assumptions.
Yeah.
And I believe that they were cyber attacks on some level, at least, to a point where they maybe didn't shut, they shut down certain servers and then the whole thing went down. But this is a good test for Europe, seeing what they're doing to the US. Maybe they can create their own sense in Europe. I mean, EY is a British company in the first place. Deloitte has services over there. Like I said, Booz Allen does. So they're going to potentially work, and other smaller firms will also do the same to help boost civilian, federal, and military systems. So this could be somewhere where the US and the EU can collaborate on as well to bring a stronger. It doesn't all just have to be industrial. It should be a part of it. But I think if they continue to focus investment with these firms and with smaller local firms to build up cyber systems and stronger governance and how they react to any cyber threats or anything of the sort, it will help. It'll benefit both the US and the EU, create a stronger relationship as well, and maybe push Russia further back in this war.
Yeah, I like the point you made about whether US for US contractors and EU collaboration. I mean, if the if these US contractors go into Europe and say, well, they're already there, but their offices are like, okay, here's what this smaller kind of business is doing that, we didn't think of. Let's work with them. So I'm thinking, what if there's like business, well, contractor to contractor collaboration efforts on certain projects where you combine the minds of, let's say, some geospatial geniuses at Booz Allen with like a smaller firm that does, also that type of work, or have the technologies to further help the geospatial geniuses to do their work. So I wonder if we're gonna ever see this type of collaboration and work effort between businesses and in the United States and the EU. But I think, what I wonder is whether or not this will be a permanent move, a permanent investment kind of thing, where they, integrate this into the budget, or is this, a temporary thing, and they go back to kind of their goals of, net zero and digitalized economy. So I don't know if this will be permanent. I think this is just something that they want to experiment with, because now is a good time to do it. Their borders are constantly strained by, the fear of Russia, and with the Ukraine situation as well. I think this will be a temporary kind of thing, and then if they if the EU sees the benefit, sees their economy growing as a result of upping their pro their EIB upping their investments in the defense sector. I wonder, I hope maybe this might be something that they will pursue.
Well, I mean, as we've seen with the United States post World War, we got in and we haven't left. So I think the EU might get in and see the benefits of, and maybe even European companies will, who are already in that sector, will grow. I mean, Volkswagen used to be a large defense producer, not for the right team, but they're on the right team now, so they'd be good. They'd be good to maybe continue doing what they did back in World War II when they were with the Nazis, except on the good side. So that could be something that we see, and I think overall it would be good. A lot of engineers we come out of Europe, a lot. And if you really do look at a lot of defense contractors in the United States, I mean, Koniag is a German contractor. Or has a very large German base. I'm not sure if it's completely German. Germans always come over to the US, so they probably will be a hub. And same with British. They could be a hub for contractors in Europe. So, but it's a good thing. I mean, I think it's the only place where the private sector, especially in the US, where the private sector and the public sector actually collaborate very well. Outside of that, the defense sphere, it's not too good, but it
Yeah.
could be something beneficial.
I kind of want to see where this goes with the public and how they feel about, the EIB focusing more investment on defense. I do want to see how the public in Europe feels about it if this continues to progress. So, but we're seeing that kind of right wing, or that right shift, in Europe. So who knows, maybe people are pro for it. Of course, there's going to be people against it, but I do want to see what kind of the overall sentiment and the overall feeling is about this. But
for sure. I'm sure there'll be polls coming out soon.
Oh, yeah. But you want to go straight into to Haiti now?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, we've seen, I'm sure everyone has seen what's going on within Haiti right now. The gangs, there's basically no government. The prime minister is not even in Haiti at the moment. The gangs are trying to take over, causing violence in small localities. But these Haitian gangs are now looking to seize control of the main international airport. It's called, I'm going to butcher this, it's in French. It's Toussaint Louverture International Airport. They've already exchanged gunfire with police and soldiers multiple times. One police officer has been confirmed killed, a couple injured. Many more of the gangs have been, gang members have been killed. Haiti has been under a state of emergency for over the past 72 hours now. A large number of police and military force has been stationed at the airport to make sure it continues to be under government control. And obviously we know of the UN-backed mission to mobilize 1,000 police officers from Kenya to help control the area, to make sure that it doesn't continue and the violence doesn't continue to escalate over the next few months. But it just seems like it keeps getting worse. And really, policymakers don't know what to do.
Yeah, let's bring this back to 2010 with the earthquake in Haiti that devastated the country with hundreds of thousands of deaths, right? So the thing is, the international community, when they wanted to go in and bring aid to Haiti, they did a terrible job at it. The reason it is to this point, I can argue, is as a result of failure to create structure in Haiti after the earthquake. There was so much crime in Haiti after the earthquake because the earthquake caused jails to be destroyed, which then allowed gangs to escape jail. And ever since then, gangs have been organizing and trying to take control because they're using this time where, you know, when the earthquake happened to situations like this where there is no government present. Like you said, the prime minister is not even there. So they're using this time now to gain control. And you know, them trying to take control of the airport is huge because now you've just controlled a major part of the country, you know, that allows imports and exports, migration in and out. So these gangs they're out of control now of the government. And, you know, the UN sending the police officers, you know, what are they going to do? The Haitians don't already trust international organizations as a result of the failure back in 2010. So, you know, the UN coming in and saying, all right, here's a few police officers. You know, what do they do? What is their mandate? What is their goal? How can they stop these gangs? You know, all those gangs versus, 1,000 police officers that can't do much besides just sit there and, you know, hope they don't get attacked by these gangs. I mean, which they are already a target. I mean, if you're wearing a blue helmet in Haiti, you're already a target. You know, if you're wearing anything that says aid on it, you're a target because the aid that was supposed to help in 2010 failed, and now I would also say that this is partly 50% to 70% our fault for failing to control, well, failing to help Haiti back in 2010.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the UN, this is another case of UN failure. So the Security Council unanimously adopted a resolution in April of 2017. To have all the 2,370 peacekeepers in Haiti be slowly withdrawn till mid-October. So for 7 years, they did what? Nothing. The violence got so bad that the 2,000 peacekeepers were not able to do anything except wait, protect themselves, you know, not fire unless they're fired upon. They weren't able to produce aid because the gangs were becoming so violent. And now the violence is continuing to escalate. Now, the one thing I do really like about this Kenya support is that they are not UN troops. They're police officers from Kenya. So, yes, the UN backed the resolution, but they're not peacekeepers. So they have a little bit more authority to, you know, use force to take care of the gangs. So I like this. I think this is probably the UN's best decision in terms of fighting a gang or terrorist regime in a country ever, because they use their security, they use the peacekeepers, but what are the peacekeepers supposed to do? They can't fight. They're only there to protect if civilians or themselves are being fired at. They're there to have aid and to try to, you know, move the continuity of whatever government was left. So this is probably the best step that they've made ever. To actually use non-UN officials, authorize the mission to go in and have them completely take out. I mean, they were going to do that in Iraq when Bush did that, but Bush just, he did it anyway. But this is the first time, I think, since then that they authorized outside peacekeepers to go in and take care of something, because they have a lot more leeway. They are under Kenyan commanders and Haitian commanders that can actually fire and deploy missions and tactics to take out these gang members.
Mm-hmm. And part of the thing is also like the lack of government, you know, which also means lack of structure and lack of, you know, motivation to try to control the situation. Since 2011, there has been two or three corrupt kind of presidents, prime ministers, in Haiti. One, the first one, Michel Bartley, he won. And then he engaged in corruption. 2017, another a business giant that exported bananas won, but then he was quickly helping gangs commit massacres by providing them money, weapons, and government vehicles. So we also have this trend of where the country is in such bad shape, and even the people within don't believe that they could, you know, turn things back. Where governments, the leaders of this government, are also using this time to engage in crime, and that will fuel, you know, these organizations, these gang members, and with their lack of leadership, also caused by us meaning the global community, gangs are like, okay, well, if we don't have anyone that can figure it out, we'll try to gain control, and now we're gonna see a situation where, you know, they're going to get control of the airport, which then might lead to control of the capital, which then might lead to a country run by gangs. I mean, right now, with no one being there as the head of Haiti, who's in control? Because right now it looks like the gangs.
Yeah, and if they can control that airport, I mean,
it's over.
It's basically over for anyone. I mean, they're lucky that the Kenyan troops have already gotten stationed there, or else it could have been way, way worse. Well, yeah, I think the United Nations and, quite frankly, the United States, because this is in our backyard, completely failed the Haitians. And so we need to, as a society, look at this and say, how could we have let the collapse of so many governments? I mean, this isn't just there. I mean, the Congo is one of them. Ethiopia and Eritrea are in a border security. Somalia is very big parts are held by terrorists. So we're still in an age where we cannot figure out how to destroy people who are organizations who are killing civilians and completely decimating a country. We need to take a look and say, okay, what we've been doing is not working. Let's switch it up. And I think Kenya, of all countries, Kenya came out and said, all right, well, no one's going to do something. I mean, we're going to do something because this is ridiculous. We are looking, we have it in our backyard, two countries in our backyard who are going through the same thing, who Kenya is helping out with the Congo, especially also in Somalia and Eritrea. They have been utilizing their resources to help there. But there's another country across the Atlantic that they see that needs help, and they're the first ones to step up and say, all right, we'll send over 1,000 troops. That should say something about the United States. And I know we're occupied, and Europe is occupied with the war in Ukraine and potentially a war in on the Taiwan Strait. But we can't sacrifice 1,000 troops like Kenya can with our 2 million man military to at least provide logistics and aid into the country. I think that's a little ridiculous. I think that combined, we should be able to send at least a couple hundred to provide support and logistics to these Kenyan soldiers and the Haitian soldiers, mm-hmm. especially.
Absolutely. And I like how you said logistics and support only for the Kenyan troops. Because I was going to go into talking about how, okay, if Kenya wants to provide their troops, the international community should at least give them the things they need to go in there. Basic necessities for the troops to live. Housing, food, water, etc. Now we need a kind of arm to say, okay, we've given the Haitian troops the things they need. Now we need to extend our arm to the Haitian people, but through Kenya. Because Haitians don't want the United States, and they don't want USAID in there. They don't want any other international organization. But if we could use these Kenyan troops, up their number, and use them as a proxy to provide support and make up for the mistakes we made, I think this would be a fantastic place to start to kind of fix, to kind of reverse our mistakes. It has been since 2010, 14 years. 14 years. And nothing has been done in Haiti. And it keeps getting worse and worse and worse. So why not use this time as an example to show the world, hey, we messed up 14 years ago, but let's stop these gangs now. What's not to say that these gangs will now, they have 80% control of the capital, according to the United Nations. 80% control. If they control the capital, they control the country. It'll be a hub, eventually, for crime, for weapons trafficking, for drug smugglers. They could go from South America into Haiti, and then go on to the rest of the world. Now, this becomes more than just an inner threat, but then Haiti becomes a global threat. It could be a hub for narcotics and weapons. We're not thinking about that either, why it actually matters. It matters because it's for our security. Every country in this world matters. People think, oh, it's just Haiti, it's some island, you know, we don't got to worry about it. We do, because organized crime will find its way to a country, and organized crime will expand its network. That's just how they will find any place to do it. Mafia, exactly. Cartels, they will find a place to do it. And Haiti right now, if this keeps going, will become another hub.
100%. I mean, the cartel in Mexico exploited Colombia, which Bill already had a very large gang in Colombia as well to move drugs, to move specifically cocaine. And you look at even, you know, previous mafias in the United States, Italian, Irish, and Russian, they did the same thing. They exploited outside sources to move their stuff to make money. Not just drugs, not just weapons, but illegal gambling. And we saw a rise in crime in the 80s and the 90s. So you're right. Every country does matter. And not just because there could be a threat to security, but because they are people. They deserve to have a right to live and not live in fear of dying every single day. And we have failed multiple times, but we put 870 billion in this last appropriations in 2023 to the United States military and our intelligence services, all that. Why aren't we going to use it? Why aren't we going to use it? We should absolutely, when there's something going on, we should use at least part of it, whether it's intelligence, logistics services, or soldiers on the ground, or you know, use our Air Force to target other areas that can help provide, you know, support and knock out strongholds in the country. Why aren't we using that? What's the point of our budget if we're not going to use the entirety of it?
I fully agree. I mean, even, like, I want to go back to the cartel and mafia topic. Weapons, U.S. weapons, are already in the arms of these Haitian gangs. Now these outside gangs, outside powers, outside, you know, cartels are going to come in and say, oh, you have U.S. weapons on your hand. We'd like to buy them. And they're going to keep getting smuggled in from the United States into Haiti, and then they're going to be in the hands of criminals all over the world. So I just wanted to add that because I just thought of that as well. I just read something where they're all the weapons that these gangs have originate from the United States, which is also crazy. How are they ending up in the hands of these Haitians?
Yeah,
kind of interesting to think about. So good research place right there.
Yeah, I mean, What do we fund the DHS for? To protect our borders, you know, to make sure that weapons aren't being moved over the borders, make sure the drugs aren't being moved. That's legitimately DHS's entire job. Why it was created in 2002 by Bush, and they're not doing good at it at the moment for any reasons. You know, they're not, even the immigration services are not able to process the amount of people because we're not moving the money anywhere. We're just telling people what to do. We're like, well, we don't have the money. It's somewhere. We'll find it. When? I don't know.
It's in the budget somewhere, but
yeah,
you know.
And Congress, of course, without, you know, pushing these appropriations. I mean, the DHS hasn't been funded for this year. We're already in March. Neither has the DOD. So we're in shambles at the moment, and we're not able to even do anything. So this is the whole mess worldwide, politically, everything. It's horrible.
Yep. Cool. That kind of wraps up our latest global developments. Josh, if you have any other things to say, we could just wrap it up.
I'm all good.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you all for watching this latest Global Developments episode, and we look forward to having you in our topic of the week.